Merry Christmas from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. How about you, Old Devil Moon, on a clear day you can see forever? Just a few of the songs composed by Burton Lane. On this edition of Fresh Air, Burton Lane talks about the songs he's written and the lyricists he wrote them with. Also, artist William Wegman on photographing his two favorite models, his dogs, Man Ray and Fay Ray. And we have a poem from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has renewed his insistence on a link between the Palestinian question and talks on the Persian Gulf crisis. The Iraqi leader made his remarks in a televised speech to a delegation from Jordan. He insisted that the Arab-Israeli conflict should take priority in any discussion of the Gulf crisis. According to the official Iraqi news agency, Saddam also charged the United States and so-called international Zionism with waging an unfair campaign against Iraq. The Iraqi leader also reportedly called for renewed dialogue with the U.S. It's reported from Iraq that at least 10 ambassadors are now back in Baghdad after being recalled for urgent consultations. The ambassadors are from many of the countries opposing President Saddam Hussein. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports that the move comes amid growing concern among foreign diplomats based there about the lack of dialogue over the Gulf crisis.
The official reason given for the simultaneous recall is that it's timed simply to coincide with the Christmas holiday in the West. However, there's inevitable speculation here that it could signal at least an ambassadorial reshuffle or even an imminent change in the Iraqi position. But in what direction, nobody is willing to guess. Western and other non-Arab observers are concerned, though, at the absence of diplomatic activity between the Iraqis and the Americans over the deadlocked issue of suitable dates for the proposed meetings at top level. Some of these diplomatic sources are suggesting that the time could be ripe for third-party intervention. What they're agreed on is that as the deadline approaches, it is essential to get talking underway again at whatever level is possible.
The BBC's Bob Simpson. The Soviet Parliament today voted to give Mikhail Gorbachev more legal power than any president in the country's history. Jenny Abdo reports from Moscow.
The Parliament greatly expanded the powers of the presidency, placing all government ministers under his control. Gorbachev also won the right to overrule controversial decisions made in the republics if he decides they violate Soviet law. The vote came as no surprise. Gorbachev has pressed hard for expanding his powers, saying there was no other alternative to rescue the country from economic chaos and prevent further bloodshed in some of the rebellious republics. But he failed to win approval on several other changes in his plans to restructure the government. Parliament agreed to create a vice presidency, a post Gorbachev favored, but it limited its authority. Today's voting was not the final word on the presidential package. The Parliament must still give final approval on the entire plan, holding out the chance that Gorbachev could still push through his version of the government reorganization. For National Public Radio, this is Jenny Abdo in Moscow.
And this is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songs How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, and You're My Thrill were written by my guest Burton Lane. Many of his songs were composed for movies, but he wrote some of his best-known melodies for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He's collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. Some of Lane's best-known songs, and some obscure ones, are included on the new record Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook. What makes the record special is that the 77-year-old composer is featured at the piano accompanying Feinstein. The song they open with is one that Lane wrote with lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane accompanying him at the piano. We'll hear the verse from that original recording, then segue into the new recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls are falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work, we never shirk. In a happy land of tinsel and gauze, because we like applause.
Britton Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you two names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old, and this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engaged in some trifling, very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative. Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, I had to take one too.
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to take, my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, Bert, play, and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, I'll do it if you sit alongside of me. So he was sitting, facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, is this your son? And he said, yes. And she said, my name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back. And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for a Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remick's music publishing company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remix, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
So did you work by assignment? Were you told what kinds of songs were needed, or were you just supposed to churn out songs?
No, I was just supposed to turn out melodies, and which I did. None of them were I think I only had one song published. I remember the first song I ever wrote was called Broken Butterfly, but I can't tell you how it goes. I've forgotten.
Was it the song publisher who suggested changing your name from Levy to Lane?
No, that was a radio executive, a broadcasting executive. I can't remember, was it NBC or CBS? When he heard me play, I don't remember why I played for him or what the intention was. My father took me to play for him, that's all I remember. And he said, I think it would be a good idea if you change your name. I don't think it made any difference. I think I could have stayed with the name Levy and done as well as I've done with Lane.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, Fran Chartown. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
The song that was used for that movie, well, one of the songs that was used for that movie was Everything I Have Is Yours.
That's right.
Beautiful song. And who in the movie sang it?
It was sung by Arthur Jarrett, who was the current big singer, such as Bing Crosby was at that time. He had his own radio show, and he was the one who sang the song. And the song, everybody knows, Everything I Have Is Yours, You're Part of Me. I got a call one day shortly after the song was purchased, and I was asked if I could think of something for Joan Crawford to do in the song because she was dancing with Clark Gable by the bandstand, and as she danced by, they wanted her to have something to sing. And I thought of a little phrase, da-da-da, da-da-da-da, which she hummed. And that became part of the song. And all the orchestrations that came out at that time, going back 1933, had that little phrase that she hummed in the picture.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show. On the bill were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs. Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody which had been done by many people in vaudeville called Airly Airly. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl, and he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her, which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week, and she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition, and the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening, because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out. And some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years. And in 1941, was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You.
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein, and there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralph Fiedler wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus, and it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I did recorded on the record, and I think it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it? Composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You. You know, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Yeah. Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listening, the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, How About You? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Fried. Ralph Fried. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
You're featured on piano on the new record. I wonder how much have you performed over the years?
Well, I have. I'm not really a performer. I have performed for. On a board of ASCAP, and on occasions they've had affairs where they've asked me to do a medley, and I've done that. Or when we're honoring one of our colleagues, I'll do one of his or her songs. But I've never really been a performing songwriter.
I love your playing. I wonder if you've wanted to play more in public over the years.
Well, I'm not one who, up until now, has enjoyed performing too much. I tremble at the idea. I'm always afraid I'll forget the lyrics or hit a bad note or something. I worry before I go on.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is composer Burton Lane, and he's written the score for several Broadway shows, including Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He accompanies Michael Feinstein on the new album. Michael Feinstein sings the Burton Lane songbook, and some of Lane's best-known songs, such as How About You and Old Devil Moon, are featured on here, as well as some lesser-known songs and even a couple of new ones. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Burton Lane is my guest. You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Harburg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. But most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Did this new record with Michael Feinstein bring you out of retirement?
I've never retired.
I wasn't sure about that.
Well, I'm sure. I've never stopped writing. I've always kept writing, and I think it's important. I remember once during the Depression when things were rough, or actually it was a recession in Hollywood, and it was so discouraging to sit down and write because I couldn't get a job. And I remember when I finally did get one, it was very difficult to start the creative juices flowing, and I think it's just like an athlete. You must keep in shape, and so when I've learned that lesson, I've never stopped writing. In fact, on the album, there are a couple of new songs, and I'm very proud of those songs.
Was there a period where you felt that Broadway or musical movies had changed sufficiently so as to kind of leave you out?
No, I don't think so. One of my problems has been finding a lyric writer that I could really team up with. I remember many times I tried to convince Yip Harburg that when you're a team, you grow together, you have a continuity of work together, and I think that's important. All one has to do is look at the careers of Richard Rodgers, who had a long career with Larry Hart, and then when that broke up and Larry died, he had Oscar Hammerstein. And it was after Oscar died that Dick was in the same situation that most of us are in who don't have a team. He wrote with many writers, never really found a mate, so to speak. So that's one of the problems that I personally have, is not having a steady lyric writer.
But you'd like to have one if you could.
Oh, yes, I would, sure.
I should ask you before we wrap up, how did this collaboration between you and Michael Feinstein happen?
Well, it was Michael's idea. He came to me with this idea. We have been friends. Actually, I knew that Michael had worked for Ira Gershwin, but I never had a chance to meet him until there was a memorial service for Ira in New York, and Michael was there. And I met him that day. And we became friends. And when he would come into New York, we'd meet and spend a couple of hours together around a piano. He would sing, I would play. And it was Michael's idea that I join him in an album. And I said, well, Michael, you know, you do so well for yourself when you're playing. Why do you need me? He said, well, this is what I'd like to do. And that's how it happened.
Is this album changing your life in any way?
I think it's on the verge of changing it. I appeared at the Golden Theater on three occasions. Michael had asked me to do this. And the reaction of the audience was so overwhelming that it kind of shook me up. One of the things I realize is that when we write songs that people like, that those songs are making friends for us. And we, as the writers, don't know who these people are until we appear before them. And it was just an amazing experience. So I don't know. This experience might change my future life, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And I also want to thank you for writing so many great songs. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Burton Lane, the composer. And you can hear him as a pianist as well as a composer on his new album with Michael Feinstein called Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook, Volume 1, which means there's going to be a Volume 2, right?
I hope so. The songs are already recorded, and they're in the wings, ready to go.
Good luck with it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I look in your eyes, and suddenly it's Christmas. And what a surprise when suddenly it's Christmas. When you speak my name, not only do I tingle, sleigh bells jingle. My practical brain says miracles don't happen. Then who can explain the magic when you're near? You defy logical reasons. You are my love for all seasons. 'Cause one look at you and suddenly it's Christmas. One look, that's all it takes for me to light up like a tree, my holiday.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Merry Christmas from Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1982, the art world lost one of its greatest models, a blue-gray short-haired hound named Man Ray. For over 10 years, artist and photographer William Wegman immortalized his pet dog, wrapping him in yards of tinsel or posing him in the manner of classic paintings. Coming up, Wegman tells us about his collaboration with Man Ray and his current partnership with another pet dog named Fay Ray. Also, poet Mark Halliday reads one of his works. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. After a turbulent debate in the Soviet Parliament, President Gorbachev was granted more extensive executive power to manage the Soviet Union. UPI's Michael Collins reports.
The action by the Congress of People's Deputies gives President Gorbachev sweeping new powers. It replaces Premier Ryshkov's Council of Ministers with a smaller cabinet of ministers that will be directly under the president. In that way, Gorbachev has direct control of the ministries that still govern nearly every aspect of life in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev's only concession to fears that he would abuse his new powers was to drop plans for a Supreme Control Commission that would have wide latitude to make sure presidential decrees are carried out. Michael Collins, Moscow.
Military forces seized power in the South American nation of Suriname, ousting an 18-month-old civilian government in a bloodless coup. The government apparently offered no resistance. The leader of the coup announced an interim government would be formed to run the country until national elections can be held within the next 100 days. The overthrow came a week after the head of the armed forces and ruler of the former Dutch colony resigned his post in protest after being temporarily detained in Amsterdam. The leaders of Saudi Arabia and Egypt have asked Saddam Hussein to reconsider his position over Kuwait and prevent a war in the Gulf. In a statement at a meeting in Qatar of the six-member Gulf Corporation Council, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia said the Gulf states would go to war if there was no other way of liberating Kuwait. He appealed to President Saddam to make a decision towards peace, and a similar statement came from Egypt's President Mubarak. The BBC's Barnaby Mason reports.
This is the most explicit statement yet from King Fahd to confirm that Saudi Arabia and its allies will, if necessary, join in a military offensive to drive the Iraqis out of Kuwait. According to a text carried by the Saudi press agency, he told other Gulf leaders that although they had not made a decision on peace or war, they had decided on the restoration of Kuwait, peacefully if peace was possible, by war if there was no other option. King Fahd said black clouds covered the sky, but he didn't want to close the door on hope. President Saddam Hussein could even now avoid a horror of which the first victims would be himself and his people. Returning to a theme he's touched on before, the king said to decide in favor of peace needed greater courage than to opt for war.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason. An Israeli military panel Tuesday rejected appeals by four Muslim fundamentalists seeking to avoid deportation. The appeals board ruled the four men from the occupied Gaza Strip were key activists of Hamas, a Muslim fundamentalist organization involved in the three-year-old Palestinian uprising. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This is the story of an artist and his dog, or dogs. William Wegman is a photographer, video artist, and painter who is best known for his pictures of his pet dog, Man Ray, named, of course, after the artist Man Ray. The dog Man Ray has been immortalized in Wegman's photographs, disguised as a dinosaur, wrapped in yarn, in a classic profile, and in dozens of other inventive poses. Man Ray died in 1982, and for the past few years, Wegman has been working with his pet dog, Fay Ray. Wegman's work comments on classic art and contemporary popular culture. His art has been shown in museums around the world. There's a new retrospective book of his work published by Abrams. I asked William Wegman if he bought his pet dog Man Ray with the idea of using him as a model.
Not really. He did enter in quite quickly because I'd just started to do photography. And getting the new puppy and the new camera. I actually just moved to California from Wisconsin.
So what was the first time you used the dog?
Probably the first day I got him when he was 7 weeks old in Long Beach, California in 1970.
And what was the photograph?
The photograph was a sock and a dog on the bed, and they both looked alike. So I first photographed him just as another thing around the house, and since he was sleeping so much, I'd plant things on him, for instance, alligators and stuffed squirrels, just props, things like that.
Did you ever wish that Man Ray could have looked at the art and really appreciated what was happening in it and how he was being used?
I really do think of him as a collaborator with me. I know that he was really aware that we were making things, not maybe that first month, but soon afterwards. He knew that we were going here to do photographs or videotapes, and that it wasn't just like playing ball or going to the beach.
When you started doing your photography and using your dog Man Ray in the pictures, this was a period when a lot of artists were beginning to use themselves as art and themselves as the subject of their art. Did you see yourself as using Man Ray instead of yourself during that period?
Well, I couldn't really afford assistance at the time, so I used myself and things around the house. And one of the troubling things about using yourself is, first of all, you don't really have a kind of distance to see what you look like. And it's kind of obnoxious, I think, after a while to be putting yourself on television. Using the dog really helped to work around that basic complaint of mine.
Do you think you went through different Man Ray periods?
Definitely.
Yeah, what are the different periods?
Well, we had a blue period that lasted one day. I guess the first pictures he was used more as a space modulator. His pointing abilities and just standing still. And in the later period, he was more of a character actor as he lost his great figure. I started to cover him up.
You also have posed him in some very classical poses and settings.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I know that I was rather schizophrenic about how I thought of him. I wanted to keep him very noble, but I wanted to do these other things too. And I think when I turned him into a frog, he still somehow got some nobility behind that. Other than when he's like this Indian chief in a canoe, which is rather
it's
powerful.
It's a very kind of classic American painting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog's in a canoe, and there's mountains behind him, and the sky is kind of overcast, and he has a very noble look on his face, and he's wearing an Indian headdress.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that might be one of the last photographs, that I might just send him off into that body of water without a paddle and then drive back to New York. It was near the end.
Oh, this was 1981. Was he sick then?
Well, he died in 81 or 82, so about 8 months after that. And towards the end of his life, I did think that each one might be the last series of collaborations. The very last pictures are rather touching and rather personal, too. They're the close-up portraits, the big heads, you might say. Some project a kind of posthumous look to them, where he looks like a Roman coin, like Julius Caesar or maybe JFK. Other times he looks kind of like an old, worn-out pet, and rather deeply human or deeply canine, I guess.
Were you ever worried that your sense of humor and playfulness with how you used Man Ray would be seen as too frivolous in the art world?
That's a huge question, and not a very funny one. But some people, when I first moved to New York, said to me quite immediately, I hate humor in art. And in a way, I agree with them. I don't like humor in art either. It's generally pointed out to be something rather trite. And I remember teachers pointing to Paul Klee and like the twittering machines as being examples of humor in art, and Alexander Calder. I think both are very fine artists, but they're not really funny like, say, a really great comic is funny. So the parallels of art and humor were a little suspect, I think.
Well, do you think of your work as having humor in it?
I think it's pretty hilarious half the time. One of my art dealers said, some of your work is funny and some of it is not so funny, and I think that's true. I mean, if it was funny, I didn't rule it out, and if it was not funny, I didn't rule it out, because that wasn't the only thing going for it.
Well, you've even had some of your work shown on the David Letterman show. Mm-hmm. What did that do to your prices? I'm really curious about that. Did they go up or what?
I don't think Letterman had much to do with that. I think that the early Saturday Night Live people,
oh, sure,
I was working
right.
With them, and I think that was an era where it was very exciting for artists to work, to get beyond and outside the gallery or museum or the usual art situations. It was really exciting until we achieved that, and then it was just another thing. So right now it seems to be just another thing, but in the early 70s it was a new frontier.
Was there a period in the late 60s or early 70s where you felt a lot of artists were taking themselves too seriously?
I think especially in video that became a problem because it was hard to, no one was telling you when to turn it off, you know, just okay, enough. When you're on real TV, you have a producer and a director saying you're off the air or stop. But a lot of performance and video artists in the early 70s just let the machine go on too long, I think. And I hope I was really careful about that, or I was very sensitive about that.
After your dog Man Ray died, you later got another dog, a female of the same breed,
mm-hmm.
And you named her Faye Ray, and you've been using her in photographs since. Did you feel guilty at first, like you would be perceived as trying to replace Man Ray, who you were so close to?
I didn't get another dog that I worked with for 4 years after Man Ray, so it wasn't the day afterwards. And I didn't work with Faye for one whole year because I didn't want to do that. I was especially careful not to do that. I really thought it was over. But one day I just decided to see what it felt like. And it felt great. It felt like I was really denying myself a basic pleasure and right, and that's to photograph a dog. Suddenly I realized who I was for a moment. And since then, I've photographed Faye many more times than Ray, and I've only had her 6 years. And Ray, of course, I had 12.
It seems to me you're really working with the gender differences between Man Ray and Faye Ray. You know, there's one shot of Faye Ray where she has her claws painted with red Revlon nail polish, and you've got her posed in gowns and exotic clothes.
There's a slight misunderstanding here. There was a piece called Faye Ray where I painted Man Ray's toenails red.
Oh.
But that's
well,
what
you are gender bending.
But yes, Faye is also much, she's got a whole different shape than Man Ray. I really used Man Ray at the Polaroid studio with those large format pictures when he was 9 years old. And of course, Faye was 1 year old when I first brought her there. So I was using a young, very thoroughbred looking healthy dog as opposed to an aging character actor to the studio.
You know, now that I mention it, I'm remembering that the Faye Ray, where it's a Man Ray who's posed and his claws are painted red, it's actually F-E-Y because, you know, he's Faye with the nail polish on.
That's right.
I forgot about that little pun in there. I should have remembered that.
That was, in fact, the first color Polaroid I took of Man Ray, and I had never used color before, so I used it in a very self-conscious way as a black background with a gray dog and just the smallest amount of red introduced in a literal way.
Well, let me get back to the subject of gender mm-hmm. and posing your dogs. Do you feel like you're using their gender differently?
Oh, I definitely am. And I'm also using what I mentioned before is their age differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of having had Man Ray pass away of their mortality. So I know that a 1986 picture when Faye was very young, can never be redone again. And that was when she had maximum flexibility. And I think right now she's looking even more feminine, but in a matriarchal way, because she had a litter of puppies. And she's filled out. She looks like a wonderful wild animal and a mother at the same time. This is a strange combination.
Artist William Wegman is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist William Wegman is my guest. A few years ago, back in 1985, you started painting again.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you give up painting in the first place?
Well, in the 60s, painting was dead. You wouldn't be caught doing it. If you were making a painting, you would call it a wall piece. So I didn't want to be caught dead doing that. It was just not really there. As a young, arrogant grad student, I gave up painting in 1966 and went on to do, after wall pieces, I did floor pieces, outdoor pieces, and floating things down the river pieces, and then finally video and photography. So that was my route there.
Well, did you ever have the impulse to paint, even though it wasn't maybe so hip at the time to be doing it?
Well, I think actually when I started painting again in 85, it was more as though the type of paintings that I was doing right before I went to art school as a juvenile or as a, my 10 and 12-year-old paintings of cowboys and Indians and pirate scenes. So I was kind of skipped art education to pick up where I left off at age 12.
When you started painting again, did you feel like you had any technique left? Did you feel like you remembered how to paint?
Oh, I did in a way, but in retrospect, I didn't really. I mean, my first paintings I did, I said, hey, these are great. I really know how to do this. But by next year, I realized that I didn't. So I kind of marched through my techniques pretty quickly.
What got you involved in art in the first place?
I think I just ruled out every other thing by having such bad grades in high school, and I needed an A, and I took art. And my art teacher said, you're really talented. You should go to art school. And so I did. And it's kind of really changed my life. Art was really important to me as a child, but as a teenager, I was more interested in sports and didn't see myself going to Canada to play hockey for the Canadiens. So... I took up art instead without knowing really what it was.
When your teacher told you that you were really talented, what did that mean, that you could draw a realistic-looking face or a realistic-looking street scene?
Well, probably. I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but it was probably some sort of landscape drawings and paintings. Mm-hmm. And I always did watercolors based on scenes outside my window in Western Massachusetts or... pouring through the World Book Encyclopedia, which is pretty much still my source for my paintings right now.
How are you using it now?
I just kind of browse through my 1950s World Books and find images, which I just kind of shop for images. Trains, planes, mining scenes, turnpikes, Just look through any of those encyclopedias and you'll see my paintings. But or you can go to a gallery and see them.
While we're on the subject of your images, there's one image I really want to ask you about in one of your paintings. There's two, I don't know if they're apartment buildings, but they're two several-story-high buildings, like maybe 20 stories or something. And each building is separated by a few inches. And this is from the perspective of looking down at the roof. And on one roof... there's a man with a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other roof, there appears to be two people. This is all very kind of through a haze. You know, there's two people holding up third person by their arms and kind of dangling them over the edge of the roof.
Well, I saw that as a family photography session where the mother is dangling her daughter between the skyscraper and the father is taking the photograph of the child. And I didn't put in the expression, but you can assume some sort of terror look on the child's face. So it's a kind of a family how-to in photography, how to get good expressions from your children, I guess, in photography. So it is rather a sinister subject, I think.
Gee, what are you saying about photography in there?
Well, I love those books on how-to in photography, these helpful tips. So it's just taking it to some absurd place, which is... But a lot of my own photographs tend to do, and drawings especially. They take a very logical scene. Like, I think I actually just did pluck that family group off a ground. The ground, you know, it said showed the mother tossing the child around, and instead I just relocated over between two skyscrapers, like the World Trade Center.
Some of your photographic work is with these large format Polaroids that are. How large are they?
They're 20 by 24 inches.
Mm-hmm. What are the advantages for you of working that big, working on that scale?
One advantage is just it's a standard size that I don't have to reconsider afterwards. It always comes out that size.
Mm-hmm.
It's instant. In other words, in about 70 seconds, I see what I've done on the scale that I'm going to be ultimately showing it at. So it's not a process. It's just there. And I can say, it's not there, and we have to do this, or it's there, and I can do something else.
Does it also provide instant gratification because of that?
Well, instant knowledge is what it is,
right.
To know that you're done and you can go on. And with my other photography, I use a Hasselblad 2.25 format. I have to wait a day to get the film back to know if I had it done, and by then I may not continue with it, or I may.
Right. Oh, I want to get back to your early pictures and then going to art school. I mean, your early paintings were pictures,
mm-hmm.
You know. Then you went to art school and you gave up on painting. I'm thinking about what it must have been like to turn your back on the form that got you into art in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I think things move very quickly when you're young. When you're 19, you learn something, and by 20, you've learned that it's embarrassing and passé, and by 22, you're on to something even more urgent and tremendously important. But by the time you're 40, things have a whole different pattern to them. So I was racing through art movements in my young years to establish my own credentials, to find something that was my own. And I guess I was, along with everybody else in the 60s, turning things upside down and finding new this and different that's. You know, to arrive somewhere that hadn't been so trodden over.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your art.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
William Wegman, a retrospective exhibition of his work, is currently touring Europe. It comes to the U.S. in 1991. A book of Wegman's work has just been published by Abrams. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up next on All Things Considered, Deborah Amos reports on Christmas with U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. Also, new research casts doubt on earlier findings that linked alcoholism to a single gene. Susan Stamberg has a special report on Bing Crosby, about the singer as a singer, not about the disclosures of Crosby's personal life. And we'll talk with David Greenberger, who's the editor of a remarkable little magazine called The Duplex Planet. It consists of transcribed excerpts from his interviews with former residents of a Boston-area nursing home. Their answers to his questions weren't intended as artful prose or poetry, but they do read an awful lot like it. Coming up next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The holidays are a time for reflection. Here's a poem from Mark Halliday.
Life's Bounty. Hungry at midnight, you open the refrigerator in a dark kitchen and wow, Shangri-La. The green and red and orange foods in their cartons and jars, olives, juices, chocolate syrup, yellow butter, brown bread, and back by the blessed blazing bulb, leftover spaghetti sauce with latent power in its deep Mediterranean redness. As life goes on, there will be times when I feel that a sudden alertness to life's bounty, e.g. food, is enough to make a poem, a celebration sort of poem, and I'll write it and feel okay about it, but it won't be a poem that really matters to me or you, because interesting truth, like interesting pleasure, is so triple-edged and marbled. It's so mixy. Either the snack you fix turns out to be stale, or you're thinking about your father's anger or your spouse's bad luck or your next job, and you don't quite taste it. Or the snack is delicious and you eat it and then it's gone, and soon you go to sleep. What we need is some complication of the idea of life's bounty, how its mixiness is actually inseparable from our sometimes loving it. the thrill of joy being that you know the joy is both unlikely and temporary. If you could fully have your way, it wouldn't stay your way for long. How did Wallace Stevens put it? He said, "Delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds." I love being able to quote those lines. I love the fact that they're his and not mine, while I worry that mine are nothing next to his, while I worry that he wouldn't admire my use of them. And when you love seriously, you love something, a dog, a poem, a lover or friend, for being more independent and complicated than your selfishness would have planned. Now, the personal example I'd have expected myself to give at this point might have involved a love affair. Quote, "And when I watched her slide out of bed at dawn, dot, dot, dot." But I was just remembering a dinner at Mike's Gourmet Fast Foods with Annie and Peter and Peter's 3-year-old niece, Katie. I had a mocha frapp, 3 scoops, with the 3rd scoop floating, a Swiss burger, and an order of fried mushrooms. Katie grew tired of her large vanilla cone much too soon and wanted to ramble. One of us had to keep tabs on her, while the other two chewed fast so we could take her home from the too exciting drive-in and coax her towards sleep. I'm not good at chewing fast. I try to savor things. The dinner quad dinner was thus not wholly satisfying. But I like the memory, the whole memory. Annie laughing when she caught Katie's scoop barehanded as it fell from her upended cone, and Peter resisting being charmed by his nuisance niece as she stood on the hood of our Fiesta and danced and sang, "I Don't Want to Go Home."
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tui, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin, and research assistance from Lisa Bocchini and Dan Buskirk. I'm Terry Gross.
Not me. Lord, I know that it's getting late, but I don't want to go home. I didn't know every baby time to wait, but I don't want to go home. Listen to the man sing his song. I don't want to go home. I don't mind if it takes all night long. I don't want to go home. I know we had to try.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a concert of music for bandoneon, violin, and piano composed by Evan Lurie of the Lounge Lizards. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the TV adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's comedy Scoop. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.